Yes, good. All right. Welcome, everybody. Good morning. Thanks for being here. I know it's probably a little bit early, especially after being in Barcelona, great city for being out late in the night. My name is Luis Vargas. I am a program manager lead in the SQL Server team. So I work with a team that builds high availability and disaster recovery for SQL Server. So in the past, some years ago, we built database mirroring, we built SQL Server clusters, and later we built always-on availability groups. So how many of you are familiar with always-on? I've been using it, yeah, in production, some people, right? Okay, good. How many people have used database mirroring in the past? Yeah, most of you, good. SQL clusters? Got it. So it's great to see you have a good expertise in all of these technologies. We're going to be talking about all of these technologies, what did we do in SQL Server 2014. And we're going to talk as well some of the things that we're doing in the next release. Again, some of these things are not fully committed, but I think it's good to always talk about some of the things that we're planning to do. And yeah, I'm going to be here during the full event. So if at any point you want to have another discussion, feel free to come after the session or later. If you have any questions at any point, just raise your hand. I hope there are some microphones over there. If not, just please speak loudly. I'll be answering questions during the session. Probably I'll take two or three after each slide, and then at the end, we'll have some more time for questions. So even before running into the session, I just wanted to show an image just to make it a little bit dramatic, right? So this is Hurricane Sandy. It impacted New York, the east side of the states, some time ago, a couple of years ago. And the reason I show you is because we had real experience with customers having to do disaster recovery with Always On at that point in time. So I remember being in calls, for example, with some customers that at that point had to do disaster recovery from New York into other cities in the states, like Portland, for example, on the west side. So anyway, just disasters happen, high availability, and being able to continue running is always essential, right? There were some. Are you familiar with a Stack Overflow? Anybody have a look at the site? It's basically a site for people to ask questions about software development or even ask for advice in some of the technologies. Anyway, Stack Overflow, they had their main headquarters in New York, and they were impacted by Hurricane Sandy. So there were some photos. I remember they sent me some photos of people carrying SQL servers upstairs, because they were getting full of water. So they had to be carrying it upstairs. And at some point, they say, you know what, this is too wet, this is too much rain. They just fell over to Portland on the other side of the states. But anyway, some interesting stories there. So today, we're going to be talking about Always On. I wanted to give a quick reminder of what we did in 2012, right? This is the first time that we introduced Always On, and then talk about 2014 specifically. So four things. These are the things that we look at every release. We want to make sure that we improve all of these areas. The first thing is we wanted to have a solution in SQL Server that was highly reliable. So we wanted to be able to identify failures in the system. So there are different types of failures. You can have failures, for example, in your hard drives. You can have failures in your network connectivity, for example. We wanted to identify all of those. We wanted to be able to stand multiple failures. So it is possible that you have one server that goes down, another server goes down, and you will still be able to run. So we want to allow you to do that. Something that was super important to have an integrated solution. So if you use database mirroring in the past, you know that with database mirroring, you have a single mirror, right? And then if you wanted to have disaster recovery, for example, then you have to use log shipping, right? You have to combine database mirroring or log shipping. Or if you were using SQL clusters, you have to use SQL clusters for high availability and then use database mirroring or log shipping for disaster recovery. So there were two technologies that you have to understand, that you have to manage to configure. So we wanted to avoid that and have a single unified solution that you could use for both high availability and disaster recovery. We wanted to make sure that you had a simple solution. So if you have used Always On, you know that we have wizards, for example, that allow you to create availability groups, to change all the properties of the availability groups. So we wanted something simple and simple to monitor. So we have a dashboard, right? And I'll show you all of these later in demos. But basically, the dashboard allows you to look at the health of the availability group. And if there is any problem, it will raise an alert, right? And then you see some red flag, and it'll give you some information. We did a flexible solution. We know that many of you have different types of environments. Some of you have invested already, for example, in SANs. How many people have SANs today? Wow, that's great. I mean, we know SANs are expensive. They're sometimes complex to configure for optimal performance. We wanted to be able to support this for customers who already did investment. At the same time, we know that some customers do not have expensive SANs, for example. They only have hardware with direct attached disks, and we wanted to be able to use those as well. And finally, we wanted to allow you to use those machines for something else than just waiting for a failover. So those machines, all those secondary servers, need to have the same hardware characteristics as the primary, because in case of a failure, you'll need to fail over, right, and continue running on those machines. So you're paying for CPU, you're paying for memory, you're paying for disk. So we want you to be able to use those resources. And finally, obviously, we want to make you able to fail over fast, right? So from the moment that we detect a failure to the moment that we fail over to the different machine, we want that to be a short period of time, because then your applications can continue running. So again, these are things that we look at every release. So we look at this in SQL Server 2012, 2014, and now for the next version. So we have two technologies, right? We talk about SQL clusters. We introduced those in SQL Server 2000, so a long time ago. But we keep investing in that solution, right? And then the new solution that we introduced in SQL Server 2012 is called Availability Groups. SQL clusters protect your full server, right? So if your server experiences a failure, we'll fail over the full server to a different physical machine. In the case of availability groups, we fail over a group of databases, right? So you specify the databases that your application depends on, and we'll fail over those databases to a different machine. Clusters are very useful in consolidation scenarios. So we have some customers, for example, that are hosting hundreds of databases. A couple of them are actually hosting thousands of databases. We have a customer that is storing 8,000 databases in a cluster. It seems a little bit too much, but they're pushing the system. So the good thing about SQL clusters is the full server moves to different physical machines. And the way that we do this is in what you call the cluster, we have one active SQL server, right? And then you have one or more passive machines. And then if we detect a failure, we restart SQL Server on a different machine. We reattach the disks so that it can access all of your databases, and then restart accepting connections. So failover takes around, it can take between 30 seconds to a couple of minutes. It really depends on the amount of recovery that SQL Server needs to do after the failover. So when we restart the server, right, we need to recover all of those databases. We need to go through a recovery process. So transactions that committed need to be reapplied to the databases, and transactions that didn't commit it need to be rolled back, right? And then that is basically what takes some time. Availability groups, again, you have multiple databases that fail over together. So if you have some application that depends on two or three databases, you put them in the same availability group, and all of those databases will fail over in case that SQL Server becomes unavailable for some reason. It doesn't require shared storage. All it needs is to have different machines with different disks. So each machine has its disks. And then SQL Server synchronizes all the transactions between the primary and the secondary servers. And the way that we do this is we have one thread per database, right, in the primary server, and then we're reading all the log, right? So we have a log that is writing all the transactions. We read the log, send it to the secondary replicas, and then those replicas will apply the log, right? So we physically send those log blocks, right, over the network, and then we receive it on the other side, and then we read the log and apply it to the data pages. Failover takes very little time, less than 30 seconds. We actually have some customers that are taking around 6 to 7 seconds. So in a very well orchestrated system, if you have an optimized configuration, it's going to be around 6 to 7 seconds. But in general, it's less than 30. Basically, all we have to do is, at the point of failover, we change a flag, right, in SQL Server, and we say, stop accepting connections on the old primary and start accepting connections on the new primary. And because you have all of those databases being standby, basically being continuously synchronizing from the primary, the failover process is really fast. Every SQL Server can host multiple instances of replicas. So what this means is, you, in the same SQL Server, you can have multiple availability groups, right? And the same SQL Server can be primary or secondary for different availability groups. So many customers use this, for example, to balance workloads, right? So one of the servers may be primary for some applications, the other server primary for other applications, but both of them provide secondaries for the other ones, right? So you provide high availability like that. Especially in disaster recovery scenarios where you have two data centers. So some customers divide applications across data, different data centers. And then the secondaries are active. So you can use them for reads, for example. You can use them for backups. So we're looking into using them for writes as well. At this point, what you can do is reads and backups. All right, so for people using SQL clusters in 2012, just a quick reminder, a few things that we did. So the first thing is we support multi-site clusters. So it allows you to basically build SQL cluster instances across different data centers without the need to stretch a virtual LAN. So in the past, you basically have to stretch a virtual LAN from one data center to the other at the networking stack, and then that will allow you to build a cluster on top of that. Now you can do it without that. So it's basically easier networking configuration. TempDB and local disks. This allows you to put your TempDB database for temporary operations, right? Anything that is temporary in SQL, from cursors, for example, to what else we use it? Index optimizations, index reveals, for example. All of those operations that require some temporary storage go into TempDB. So it's a database that is running pretty hot normally. We allow you now to store that in the local disk. So if you have SSDs, for example, very fast for TempDB. And besides of the performance, it allows you to use your SAN for your databases. So SAN storage is expensive. We want you to keep that for your own user databases and then put TempDB into local drives. Indirect checkpoints. So as I mentioned before, the failover time for SQL clusters depends on the amount of recovery that you have to do when you restart SQL Server. And that depends on how often SQL Server is doing checkpoints. Remember, a checkpoint is when we detect dirty pages. Those are pages in the memory that we haven't written to the data files. And then at that point, we go and write them into data files. So the more that you have in memory that hasn't been written to files, the more that we have to go and do after SQL Server restarts. So with indirect checkpoints, you can specify how often to do checkpoints. And basically, if you do it very often, that means that there is less amount of database recovery that we have to do, right? So this allows you to maintain short failover times in the case of SQL clusters. And finally, flexible failover policies. This allows you to specify how sensitive SQL Server is going to be to failures, right? So we have five levels, and level zero basically means the SQL Server service dies for some reason. So imagine that the service crashes, and then level five is all the way to deadlocks, for example. We detect deadlocks in SQL Server, or we detect out-of-memory exceptions. So you have many different levels in the middle, right? So depending on how sensitive you want your application to be, you can specify these levels. If you go into books online and just look for flexible failover policy, you'll be able to find the definition of all these levels. All right, availability groups. I'm going to move quickly here. I think that you have the context. So again, multiple database failovers, multiple secondaries. In SQL 2012, we introduced four secondaries. That means five replicas, one primary, four secondaries. Two of these can be synchronous, right? Everybody knows what synchronous is, right? Okay, so synchronous basically means transactions on the primary wait to commit until they are restored by the secondary, right? And this is how we ensure that all of those transactions are stored in all of the secondaries. And if the primary fails for some reason, you have a copy in the secondaries. Asynchronous means we send them as soon as they commit, and then the secondaries will receive it at some point. The advantage for asynchronous is that it doesn't block your transaction commits, right? And they, in general, what customers do is they use synchronous replicas in the same data center for high availability, and then asynchronous secondaries on different data centers for disaster recovery. We support manual and automatic failover. So with automatic failover, we automatically detect failures and move the availability group to a different SQL server. With manual failover, you can do that. So for example, you want to patch, you want to install the latest patch for SQL Server or the latest patch for Windows, you can do what is called a rolling upgrade. So you upgrade the secondary, right? Failover to the secondary, upgrade the primary, and then fail back, right? And that's how you can upgrade a system with little downtime. Again, it has flexible failover policy, so you can specify different levels of failures, and you can do this for every availability group. So if you have different applications, right, and each application has different levels of sensitivity, so you want, for example, one application to move as quickly as there is any type of failure, you can specify a high failure level. And if you have an application that you don't care that much about, you know, at which point it will fail over, you just want to make sure that if SQL Server goes down, you can specify a different failure level for that one. Finally, a feature that is very, very powerful is a feature that we don't talk too much about. It's called automatic page repair. And the idea is whenever you write a page or you read a page from a replica, if we detect that the page is corrupted, then that replica will automatically broadcast a request for that page to all of the other replicas in the system so that whenever those replicas detect the request, it will basically send back a healthy copy of the page to the primary replica, right? So what this means is if there are corruptions in pages, instead of us, you know, asking you to go and run, for example, check disk or do some failure detection on the disk or repair, we can automatically take over that for you. So I won't go into a lot of detail here. One of the important things, that we do is we support multiple features across SQL Server. So in the past, if you use database mirroring, for example, you know that with database mirroring, you could not use FastStream, right? Now with availability groups, you can use FastStream, you can use contained databases, fault tables, service brokers, etc. Any of the features in SQL Server are basically protected through availability groups. So it's a very important thing to consider. And we talk about how you can use the secondaries, for example, for RAIDs or for backups. This is how a deployment looks like. So many of our customers are doing something like this. You probably are doing something similar as well. So on one data center, you have two replicas. Some of you may have three or four. One of them is the primary. So in this case, we have this blue one as the primary, and then this has one availability group, right? And then you can have one more secondary. And in general, you configure this as asynchronous, right? As synchronous, and this provides high availability through automatic failover. And then in a different data center, you can have one or more secondaries. So for example, in this case, you can have another synchronous secondary close to your main data center, and you could use that, for example, for backups. So some customers need to have backups outside of the main data center. This is for compliance reasons, so that in case that the main data center goes down, they're still able to recover from a backup in a different place. So some of the customers are doing this. They have a synchronous secondary close to the main data center, and they can take backups from there. And then in a different part, you can have your disaster recovery site, and you can have another asynchronous secondary, right? And one of the things that you can do is you can run, for example, reports out of that secondary, right? Any questions so far? Does that make sense? All right, so let's move into SQL Server 2014 at this point. So let's talk about the things that we have. So for availability groups, First thing, we have increased the number of secondaries. So this is a very small change, but it has a big impact for many customers, and we'll talk about why some customers are required to do that. We have increased the availability of readable secondaries. So for customers that are using readable secondaries today in SQL 12, they'll be very interested to hear how we have increased their availability. We'll talk about keeping replicas in Windows Azure. Microsoft Azure. We originally called it Windows Azure. We changed the name, as usual, in Microsoft. So now it's Microsoft Azure. So we'll talk about keeping replicas in Azure for disaster recovery purposes. We enhanced diagnostics on both availability groups and SQL clusters. So we'll talk about some of the examples of things that we make it easy for you to understand how the system is behaving. And for SQL clusters, we introduced support for Windows Cluster Chair Volumes. So Cluster Chair Volumes is a new technology in Windows. It allows you to make the best utilization of your SAN, of your chair storage. So we'll talk about how we benefit from that. Okay. All right, so let's talk about increased number of secondaries. So we talk about SQL 12, we had 4 secondaries. We have increased the number now to 8 secondaries. So we basically doubled the number. Why do we do this? Why this may be important to you? So what we notice is in the past 3-4 years, we have many customers who are using readable secondaries to move some of those read workloads, like reporting, for example, or BI, into your secondaries. And this is because they want to use the secondary resources, right? And then let the primary focus completely on the OLTP workload. The advantage of doing this with availability groups in Always On is that you have a single solution that you have to configure and manage. So some of you may be using transactional replications of people, right? Got it. So replication is a great technology that we released some time ago that allows you to copy logically some of your changes, for example, from specific tables into different SQL servers, and then you can use those, we call them subscriber, basically secondary servers, to run some workloads. The disadvantage of using replication with availability groups is that you have 2 solutions, right? So that means you have to configure permissions, for example, for availability groups and permissions for replication. You have to monitor both for failures. You have to monitor for performance. So many customers would like to avoid that. So if they can do this with availability groups, it's the easiest solution. So we saw a couple of customers. For example, we have a Russian customer. They have multiple offices in the government across Russia, and they wanted to be able to run reports locally in each office. And they wanted to also support disaster recovery. So in this case, what they did is they had their primary data center in Moscow, and then they have six or seven secondary replicas across Russia, and then they can run reporting across all of Russia. We have other customers that want to scale out reporting workloads. So we have another customer. This is in Belgium. They're a beer company. They make beer, and they wanted to do reporting, and they have a SharePoint farm. And basically, they were already running reporting across 3 secondaries because they already have a separate secondary for disaster recovery, and they wanted to scale out the reporting even more. They wanted to have reporting basically running continuously all the time. So they wanted even more secondaries. So at this point, they have increased the number to 6 secondaries. Basically, they scale out the reporting across all of those secondaries. So we talk about this. We still restrict the number of synchronous secondaries to 2, right? So for high availability, will allow you to still maintain 2 secondaries, but the rest of the secondaries are asynchronous, right? And this is basically to make sure that you don't impact the performance of your primary. The secondary delay, this means how soon the secondaries will see the changes from the primary, will depend on a couple of things, will depend on the latency between primary and secondary. Right? So if you have very low latency, the secondaries will have those same changes immediately from the primary. But if you have high latency, it will take a little bit longer. The other thing that defines this is how fast the storage is in the secondary. So if you have very fast storage, for example, those transactions, right, that we receive will be applied very quickly. But if you have a slow storage, it may take a little bit of time. Based on the customers that we have, basically within the same data center is less than a second. So from the time that the transactions are committed on the primary to the time you can see it on the secondary, it's around 1 second. And it's less than 5 seconds between data centers. Right, so some numbers to keep in mind. There is very little performance impact of adding these secondaries. A couple of things to remember. The first thing is commits on the primary do not wait for the asynchronous secondaries. Right? As soon as the commit happens, we'll start sending the transactions to the secondaries, but we don't block the commits. And the other thing is, if you have multiple secondaries, right, all of those, basically we have threads in SQL Server that are sending the log records to the secondaries. All of them share this memory structure. So in memory, we maintain something called a log pool. Basically, every time that we read the log, right, from the disk, we keep it in the log pool in memory, and then all of those secondaries read it from there. So what this means is if you have 8 secondaries, instead of reading it from disk 8 times, we just read it from memory. Right? So it's a much more efficient way of doing this. So just giving you an idea, if you start with just one SQL Server with 0 secondaries, right, and then you add 8 asynchronous secondaries, the performance impact in throughput, right, of how many transactions per second you can commit is less than 1%, right? So basically it gives you the confidence that you can go and add multiple secondaries in the system without being impacted. A couple of considerations. One of the things is if you're using read-only routing, so there is this feature we introduced in SQL 2012 called read-only routing, and this means if in the connection string you specify that your connection is read-only, we'll route you to the readable secondary, right? That functionality, so today we'll still route you to the first readable secondary that's available in the system. So some customers ask, for example, to do load balancing across the readable secondaries. They want to be able to just load balance the connections, right, from the connection string. So today, unfortunately, we don't have that. We'll always route you to the first readable secondary that is available. So this works well for high availability, but it doesn't work for load balancing. So what we have customers today doing in SQL 2012 is load balancing, for example, using DNS. So if in the DNS server you go and create multiple entries, right, with the same name, and then just different IPs for the readable secondaries, then we'll automatically load balance across them through round robin. Or you can use any type of load balancer that you have. So some of you may have some hardware load balancers, like F5s, for example. Some of you may have some network load balancers in software, so you can use those. All right, so in terms of how this looks, it looks exactly the same as before, so it's not very exciting. The only thing that I wanted to show is the same exact experience as before. So in this case, if you want to create a new availability group, you can go and add as many secondaries as you want. You can configure them as readable, for example, very easy to do it through the wizards, right? So the wizard is still the same. Basically, it's a lot, it just takes more time because we have to go and configure all of these secondaries. Right, and at some point, the wizard completes, and then you have all of the secondaries available in Object Explorer. Right, you can look at all of them. You can change the properties of the availability group. Right, so you have all the replicas, and then you can change between synchronous or asynchronous, automatic or manual failover, and again, if it's readable or not. Right, so it's very easy to do. And then in the dashboard, you can look at the health of all these availability, all these replicas. One thing that is useful is this value, the health of the availability group, is a roll-up, right, of all the health of all the replicas, right? And the health of each replica is a roll-up of the health of all the databases in that replica. So what this means is, imagine that you have 5 databases, right, and then you have 8 replicas. So instead of having to look at, you know, 40 different places, you can just go here, and if there is a problem, this will indicate where the problem is, right? So it's easy to go and understand the full health of the deployment. All right, any questions so far? We're doing good? All right, so let's talk about increasing the availability of readable secondaries. So in SQL Server 2012, there is a couple of conditions where your read workloads may be disconnected. So a couple of these examples are, if you have a geo-distributed environment, this means if you have a large-scale environment where you have two different data centers, right? And imagine that there is high latency between the data centers. If you have failures, for example, in a network between the two different data centers, and those failures last longer than 10 seconds, which in some cases may happen depending on your ISP provider, if that happens, then the secondary servers on the disaster recovery side will go into something called the resolving state, which basically means SQL Server doesn't know what's going on with the rest of the deployment because it cannot access the primary. And in that state, the resolving state, all of those read connections are killed, right? So until the secondary replica is able to reconnect to the primary, the replica will move back into the secondary state, and then read connections will be accepted again. So unfortunately, we have seen some customers that have this happening more often than we wanted to have. So ISP providers depend. You know, in some cases, they are great. And in some cases, they are, for example, upgrading their equipment very often. And because of that, they may lose connectivity between the data centers. So because of that, we wanted to avoid this issue. So what we did in SQL 2012 is we have changed the behavior of the replicas so that even in the resolving state, we'll accept read connections from the clients. So let me show you one example here. So imagine that you lose connectivity between these two data centers. So these reporting workloads at that point will be killed, right? If the connection failure lasts for more than 10 seconds. So actually, before talking about the customer, let me give you one demo here. All right, so I have SQL Server 2014 here running. I have one availability group, right? The availability group has three replicas. So I have my primary. I'm currently connected to the primary. I have two secondaries, right? Both of them are synchronous, right? The first two are configured for automatic failover, and the last one is for manual failover, right? I have all the information about four of the databases. So in this case, I have a single database, right, in the replicas. I know that they are synchronized, right? That means that transactions are continuously being applied to the secondaries. And when was the last time that a transaction committed on those secondary servers? And even the last commit sequence number. So this is basically the last identifier in the log for that transaction. All right, so at this point, I can go to my readable secondary. So let me connect to my readable secondary. And then I can run some queries here. All right, so if I run a query here, I see I don't have any values. So let me go and insert some values. So I'll insert some values here. So I'll use my database. Let me insert 5 values. So I can go to my readable secondary, and I can read the values, right? And then this query is telling me the status of that readable replica. So in this case, I see that the readable replica is in secondary state, right? It's a secondary. It is connected to the primary, right? Everything is working well. And this query tells me the state of the database inside of that replica, right? Each replica can have multiple databases. So this is the status for that database. So I see that it's synchronized, that the database is online. This means available for queries. And I can see the last time that it committed a transaction and the last sequence number for the transaction, right? So let's say that I go and stop the primary. So I'm going to stop the SQL Server service, right? So in this, imagine that you disconnect SQL Server, for example, for some reason. Well, you probably don't want to do it, but if it happens. So at this point, what's going to happen? So I have one secondary configured for automatic failover, right? So that's going to become the primary. So if I go to my other replica, all right, and I look here, you see this is the primary now, right? All right, so it has taken over the primary now. So let's go and use the database here. Let's see, I insert some more values. Right, I can go back to the readable secondary, and I can read it, right? Everything is still working well. This is all the same behavior as in SQL Server 2012, right? It's still the same. Now, the new thing is, if at this point I stop SQL Server, right, I stop my new primary, what will happen? So I will stop it. This means I don't have any other primaries, right? So this is the moment where DBAs start panicking, right, because there is no primary in the system. You cannot accept any workload. However, if I go to my readable secondary, right, and then I run my workloads, they just continue running, right? No issue whatsoever. Everything works well. However, if I look here, what does this mean? It means the replica is in resolving a state, right, because there is not a primary in the system. It is disconnected because I cannot connect to a primary. I see that the database is not synchronizing. However, it's still online and accepting connections, right? And I can see again the last commit time and the last commit sequence number. So I can tell, for example, how long my secondary has been disconnected, right? Because I can tell how long it hasn't applied or committed, sorry, a transaction in the system. So my reporting applications can continue running. Everything works well from that perspective. My DBA will get a call at night and say, look, there is a problem. He will go and fix the problem. So he will come and start the service. All right, so we'll come and fix the primary. So the primary will come back online. And when it comes back online, you know, you will be able to accept more transactions. But from the readable secondary perspective, everything will always continue working. So at this point, my primary is back. And I can go and insert a couple of records, right? So I insert more records. I go back to my readable secondary, right? And then you can see everything is in the readable secondary as well. And you can see that it's, again, connected and online. So from the readable secondary perspective, it never noticed the problem, right? So it just accepted the read workloads to continue running. So very, very important for people using readable secondaries. Let me restart the previous primary as well. Any questions so far? Does that make sense? Yes?
Yes, protection level is on database level.
The protection is on database level. The protection is at the availability group level. And the availability group can have multiple databases, one or more.
Okay. Yes, but what is happening with the data stored in the system databases?
Got it. So the question is, what happens with the data in the system databases? So availability groups do not copy the data from the system databases. So every SQL Server, primary and secondary, have their own system databases. They're separate. So if you have something that lives outside of your user database, sorry, the question for everybody, the question was, what happens with objects that live outside of the user database? So if you have something living in MasterDB, for example, like logins or certificates. Today, that's something that you have to manually synchronize. So if you have logins, for example, that's something that you have to synchronize today. That's something that we are looking into for the next version so that the availability group can cover that as well. Right. Any other question? Yeah.
Thank you. If you started up the first primary server, the server one, what would happen with the asynchronous database?
If I restart the first server?
The first server, the server one, you put in some data and you switched over to number one, turning down the first one.
Yeah.
It doesn't have the same data. If you start that up first, what would happen?
Got it. So the question is, what happens to the first second? To the first, the original primary. So when the first server comes back online, right, after I restarted, it will become a secondary for the new primary, right? So it will synchronize to the new primary, and any transactions that the new primary had, it will synchronize to the secondaries, right? So the new primary always defines all the transactions and is the one that synchronizes those transactions to the secondaries, right? Okay. So let's see.
Can I ask you a question, please?
Yes.
You know, there was talk about the objects which live outside database. There are two things which concern me. One is the users and logins, and the other thing is jobs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, sometimes it gets very messy to manage the users across the primary and secondary.
Yeah.
Now, what are the best practices of that, and how do you manage the jobs? If the job is, do you keep them active on all the nodes, or do you keep them, like, some of them active on primary and some, I mean, you don't keep them active on the...
Got it. So the question is, how do I handle the jobs? Because they are outside of the user databases. So the best practice is create the jobs on all of these replicas, all of them, and then at the top of the job, at the first line, basically say, if it's not the primary, exit the job, right? So only in the primary they will execute. I will actually show you very soon. We have introduced a couple of functions to simplify basically finding the primary replica or whether it's the preferred replica for a backup or things like that. So it is very easy now. It's just a system function, and you can use that to identify if it's the primary. So only run on the primary. Okay. So let me fail over back to this server, just because I'm going to use it later for other demos. So I'll just fail over. It's actually a good demo for failing over. So imagine that you wanted to go and patch the other server. So you can just say fail over, and then next, I specify my previous primary, and I want to fail over to that one. Right? So we'll just... All it does, again, is changing a flag, saying, now you're the primary. It takes like 6-7 seconds, so it's very, very fast. All right, so I'll come back to this machine later to show you the other demos. Let's finish the presentation. All right, so I talk about Stack Overflow. There are a website for developers to ask questions about software development, a very popular website. They have millions of users. This is how their deployment looks like. So their main data center is in New York, in Manhattan. They have two servers, right? These are configured for high availability, so they are synchronous replicas for availability groups. They have 5 databases. So they have one database for people to ask questions and find answers, and then they have another one for people to look for careers, for example. And then for disaster recovery, they have one data center in Oregon, right? This is on the west side of the US. And you can look the characteristics of the machine. And then the connection is a VPN over the internet, right, between the two data centers. They're running SQL Server 2014 over Windows Server Core. All right, so Stack Overflow, the main reason why they decided to upgrade from SQL 2012 to SQL 14 was because of this increased readable second availability. And there are a couple of reasons why. The main reason is that even if they have a disaster, so even if the main data center goes down, like in the case of Hurricane Sandy, all they have to do to remain operational is move their website to the readable second on the other side, right? So in this case, 70% of the site is reads, is people looking for answers, for example. So they can simply move the website, point it to the disaster recovery site, and continue running. They prefer doing this to failing over, because if you fail over across the data center, you may lose some data, right? Because the secondary is asynchronous, right, for performance reasons. So to avoid losing data, they just change the DNS, move the website, and then continue running. So this is basically one of the quotes from the DBA for the Stack Overflow. So the increased availability means that users can still find answers, and the world keeps spinning. So one example of why they wanted to move to SQL Server 2014. So I showed you the demo already. How many of you are using Microsoft Azure today? Some, okay, like probably 20 people. All right, so Microsoft Azure is Microsoft Cloud, right? We allow you to run all the different types of workloads that you want, including SQL Server, right? Why is this important? So many customers today cannot afford a disaster recovery site, right? Disaster recovery sites are expensive. You need to have the physical environment. If you don't have it, you need to pay for rent. You need to pay for the hardware. You need to pay for some people to take care of the site. So what we did is, in SQL Server 2012, we started supporting adding replicas for availability groups in Microsoft Azure, right? So what this allows you to do is have copies of your databases that are continuously synchronizing in the Microsoft Cloud, right? And then you can use these copies, for example, to move some of the read workloads, or you can use them, for example, for failing over. So if your main data center becomes unavailable, you can fail over to Microsoft Azure and then point your applications to Microsoft Azure and continue running there. You can locate your replicas in any of the regions that we have data centers. So we have North Europe, for example, we have West Europe, and we have other sites as well. So how do you decide where to put your replicas? Well, generally it's gonna be a latency, right? So you want to maintain your latency below 50 milliseconds round trip. So that's how you can decide. Some countries have some political considerations. They need to maintain the data within certain boundaries, so you can look into that as well. And this is how it looks like. So we have customers today, for example, that have the primary and the secondary for high availability in the main data center, and they have one secondary in Microsoft Azure for disaster recovery, right? And this is generally asynchronous. Why is this good? Well, the first thing is cheap. I mean, cheap is always, it's always good. So the only thing that you have to pay for is the virtual machine. So that SQL Server in Microsoft Azure will be running in a virtual machine. You pay for that virtual machine. How much? It depends on the size of the virtual machine. We have different sizes, right? So we have very small sizes with, you know, 2 cores, for example, and 2 gigabytes of RAM, and you can go all the way to 16 cores and 116 gigabytes of RAM. All the transactions that you send between your data center and Microsoft Azure are free. You don't have to pay for any of that traffic. You only pay if you try to get transactions outside of Microsoft Azure. So if your applications, for example, are in your main data center, and then you want to connect and read data from Microsoft Azure, then you have to pay at that point. But if your applications are also in Microsoft Azure, then you don't have to pay for that, right? So imagine in case of a disaster, if you move both your SQL Server, because you fail over to the cloud, and also you move your applications to the cloud, then you don't have to pay for that traffic because everything is within the same environment. We have some customers today that have these replicas in Microsoft Azure for disaster recovery. So if you're interested, just go into microsoft.com, look at case studies, and then look for some of these customers and you'll learn more about how they're using this for disaster recovery. So we support this in SQL Server 2012. In SQL Server 2014, we added a wizard, so we make it even easier for you to go and add these replicas in the cloud. So we added a wizard in SQL Server that will allow you to do this for you, and this will take care of everything for you. So let me show you the demo. So I'm again here using my availability group, the same one as before. So if I open it, you'll see I have my availability replicas here, right? The ones that I showed you before. I can right-click and say Add Replica. This is how you add a replica today. So this is the same wizard that you have used today. The first thing that I have to do is connect to my existing replicas. And this is because I need to authenticate. I need to prove that I have permissions on those replicas because I'll have to configure the endpoints for connectivity. So this is why I have to do this. So today, you probably have seen this button. This is how you add a replica today, right? Now, we have added a new button called Add Azure Replica. And this will allow you to go and add a replica directly into Microsoft Azure. Right? So if I click this button, it tells me the first thing, it remembers if you already have used Microsoft Azure in the past. So even if you just go to the website, it will remember that. In this case, it tells me that I have connected before, but my token, this is for security reasons, it has expired. So I need to sign in. So I'll say, remain signed using this account. This is my account in Microsoft Azure. Okay. And then after it connects, it will download the list of Azure subscriptions. So any operations that you do in Microsoft Azure, you have to use an Azure subscription. So I have different subscriptions here. I can select one of them. Right. And then it will automatically download all the information for my Azure subscription. So it will, for example, download the different types of SQL Server images that are available to me. So I could select SQL 2012, SP2, for example, or SQL 2012, SP1. In this case, I'm going to select SQL 2014, right, running on Windows 2012 R2. So I select that version. I can specify the size of the SQL Server in that in the cloud. So this can go from very small, one core and 1.75 gigabytes of RAM, to 56. We're actually updating this. We need to update the wizard. There are now machines with 112 gigabytes of RAM and 16 cores, so this is coming very soon. For now, I use large. I give it a name to the virtual machine, so I can say Azure Replica, and just give it some number. This is the name of the administrator for that virtual machine and that SQL Server in the cloud. My password. Then I can select where do I want these replicas. So what you see here is virtual networks. So these are basically VPN tunnels that I have set up. So I have set up two virtual tunnels to central US and one to west US. You could set this up to any data centers in the world. So you can set up to North Europe or West Europe, for example. The way that you set up these tunnels is you go into Microsoft Azure, right? So if you haven't used Microsoft Azure, just go into WindowsAzure.com, and then on the left side here, we have networks. Let me see if I can find it here. Okay, so this icon is for networks. So you can go there, right? And then after that, you can look at all the networks that you have available. So in this case, I have already configured this VPN tunnel between central US and my data center. And you can look at the information here. So all you have to do is configure the gateway, right, on the Microsoft Azure site, right? And that basically means you create a certificate on the Microsoft Azure site, you create a certificate on your VPN site, and then you exchange the certificates, right, so that you can establish a secure connection between the two. And once you establish a secure connection, basically you can send data back and forth between them. So I have information, for example, of the data that I have sent between the two sites. So once I do that, I can specify them here. So I can select this. The final thing that I need to do is just specify an account in my domain that I can use to join that machine in Microsoft Azure to my on-premise domain. So let me do that. And then I click OK. And this basically will add, well, obviously with Microsoft, you need to agree, right, to the sign agreement. So I agree to that. Right, and now I have that replica that I just added here. So I have my Azure replica, right? It's a secondary. This is asynchronous, right? So actually, if I try by default, I cannot change it. This is to protect you because we want to avoid having the latency to Azure impacting your transaction workload. You can change it with T-SQL. So after that, you can run T-SQL and just change it. But by default, we try to protect and use asynchronous. And then you can specify if you want it to be readable or not. Right? So I want to say yes, and this will make that replica in the cloud readable. And here you specify how do you want to move your data from your on-premise SQL Server to that cloud SQL Server. So the default option is full, and full basically means take a full backup, right, and then share it in the network, right? So we use a network share, and then restore it from the second in the cloud. How long this will take? This will really depend on the size of the database and the bandwidth between your data center and Azure. So just one example, if you have a 100 gigabyte database, for example, relatively small, it'll take around 20 to 30 minutes. So again, it depends on the size of the database and the bandwidth. So at this point, I'll click next. And this is taking a little bit of time. This is because I'm using Central US. So Central is basically in the US. And then the next screen is doing a bunch of validations. So it has to do like 20 validations. We try to make sure that every operation that you will do will succeed. So we'll validate everything from making sure that you're selecting the right image of SQL Server. So you know you have to select at least an image that is the same or a higher version than the one that you have on-premise. We need to validate that you have enough space, for example, in your Microsoft Azure account so that you can store your database. We need to validate security, for example, and so on. And all of these validations are continuously right now going all the way to Central US, so it takes a little bit of time. So I'm going to probably come back to, okay, I guess it's making progress now. So you see basically all the validations that it's doing. So there is many, many validations, again, trying to guarantee that everything will succeed. The reason why this is showing is because I'm actually not using SQL 2014. I'm actually using the next version. We don't have a name yet. So I'm actually using the next version. This is something that comes from our development team. So this is why it's telling me that it's newer than the one in the cloud. Anyway, so at this point, you can go click next. And then it will show you all the information that you specify. So in this case, you know, my backup will be stored in some network share. This is the name of my virtual machine in the cloud. This is the version of SQL. It's in Central US, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you can go and execute the wizard at this point. So the wizard is going to take around 10 to 15 minutes. So it takes a little bit of time. But when the wizard completes, basically you have a replica that is synchronizing, similar to the one that you have today on-premise, but just in the cloud. Any questions with this so far? Yes.
In Azure, this is a complete VM. This is not a database instance.
Correct. So the question is, in Azure, do you get a complete SQL Server? Yes, you get a complete SQL Server running in a virtual machine. Right. Any other questions? Yes. Yeah. So the question is about the cluster configuration. So let me show you here. So the cluster basically requires all of the machines to be part of the same Windows domain. So let me show you the cluster. So all of the machines will be part of the same domain. And then because of the VPN tunnel, we basically built a virtual network between the two machines, and they are part of the same network space. So I have my cluster here, right? And then if you look at here, we have the name of the cluster. It's running online. And then you can see all the IP addresses that we have. So we have IP addresses in two different subnets. So I have IP addresses in my on-premise local subnet, and then I have one IP address in my cloud environment. So again, this is only possible because you configure a VPN tunnel in advance, right? And then you can put them in the same virtual network. So what else? Let me show you. So I think the cluster in this case is using node majority. So I have three nodes using node majority. I don't have a witness in this case. Right. Any other questions? All right, so let's go back to the presentation. All right, something else that we have done is improve the diagnostics for both availability groups and SQL clusters. So it's very important for DBAs to be able to identify a problem very quickly, and that's something that we have done. So just one example, if you have your availability group and for some reason this secondary is down, how do you go and troubleshoot that? It's just one example of something that you need to troubleshoot. So I won't go into detail here. This is just a small list. We have around 30 total improvements, right, for diagnostics. Some of my favorite ones, we show you all the X events. Anybody using X events today? No? Okay, so X events is like the next version of Profiler Traces before, is the new technology that we are using to allow to track all the state of the system. So we use this for always on. So if you have any issues in the system, the first place to go to is X events. Somebody asked about how to identify if SQL Server is the primary replica. So we added a new function called isPrimaryReplica. So you just give it the name of the database, and it will return true or false. And basically, you're simplifying a lot of error messages and give you more information in the dashboard. Let me just show you a couple of examples so that you understand, you know, some of the improvements that we did. So in this case, for example, somebody asked about aging jobs and how do I stop the aging job if it's not the primary. So you can use this function. We have sys.isPrimaryReplica. So I give it the name of my database, right? So I have my databases here, and I give it the name of one database. And then this will return if it's a primary replica or not. Right? So if I run this in a different machine, this basically will tell me that it's not the primary replica, right? So this basically just tells you whether or not it's the primary. So if you have an aging job, you will say, if not my name is primary replica, then exit the agent job. So I was talking about X events. So if you go to management here in SQL, and then you go to extended events, sessions, you'll see that we have two sessions. So system health is in general for all SQL Server. It gives you information about the health of SQL Server. And then we have one specific to Always On, right? So it gives you all the information for Always On. So this is what it shows. So you can see we have a timestamp, the name of all the different events that happen in the system. So anytime that there is an event that changes the state of Always On, it will show here. And then what availability group was impacted, what replica, and what was the previous state of the current state. So for example, something useful that you can do is say, I want to find in this column anything related to DDL. Right, so if I say DDL, for example, so I can see that at some point I executed an alter availability group failover, right? Let me see what else. At some point, I changed my replica to make it synchronous. So if you want to track any operation that you or any DBA did, you can do this, for example. Right? So in SQL 12, this timestamp that I was showing here is the timestamp of the local machine. Right? Now, the only problem is if you have machines in different geographic zones, like if you have a machine, for example, in one time zone and a different machine in a different time zone, then you'll need to make the calculation basically to know the equivalent time zones. So to simplify that, we just added an UTC, universal timestamp column, and then that UTC timestamp is basically the same across all of the replicas. So I can add my UTC column, right, and then I can sort by this UTC column, and this all the replicas in the system, even if they're in different time zones, will be using the same UTC time, so I can correlate them. Right? So it's just one of the examples of how we simplify troubleshooting. All right, so let's move on. All right, for SQL clusters. So for SQL clusters, what we did is we supported Windows cluster shared volumes. So what Windows cluster shared volumes are is shared disks. These are disks that can be accessed by all the nodes in the cluster, right? And the advantage that cluster shared volumes have is that you can have many of these cluster shared volumes in the same physical drive. So imagine in your SAN, for example, in your SAN today, you're limited by the number of drives in the system. And also, if you're already using one of the drives for Windows and another drive, for example, for DVD or whatever media you have, then you are restricted even more. So some of the customers use mount points, for example, to work around that limitation, but then you need to go and handle the mount points, and it's additional management that you have to do. So the advantage with cluster shared volumes is you can have as many as you want, right? So you could have 100 if you want, and you can have them all in the same physical drive. That means that you could have as many SQL clusters as you want in the same physical storage, right? Just using different cluster shared volumes. The other advantage of cluster shared volumes is they increase the resiliency to the storage. So if for some reason one of the cluster nodes cannot read or write to the storage, then the cluster shared volume will automatically redirect that request through a different cluster node, right? So this basically allows you to deal with transient network failures between your cluster and the storage, because then a different node will be used. Finally, failover resiliency. So today with traditional clusters, when a failover happens, we need to unmount the drives from the previous primary, mount the drives on the new primary, and then restart SQL Server. With cluster shared volumes, we don't have to do that. Basically, all the cluster nodes can just access the cluster shared volumes over SSMB. So you can use the SMB protocol, SMB 3.0, for example. And we don't have to mount on mount. So as soon as the failover happens, the new node can just go and access the chair over SMB. So it's definitely very, very useful. If you haven't started using them, please look into that. From the setup perspective, how do you go and install SQL Server? It's exactly the same as before. The only thing is that in Windows Cluster, you need to register the cluster disk as cluster chair volumes. So you create these cluster chair volumes, you register them in Windows Cluster, and once you have them, they look just as regular cluster disks in your Windows, your SQL cluster installation. Right? So in this case, for example, I can use cluster disk, one, and cluster disk four to store my database files, right? And these are cluster chair volumes. So let me show you the quick demo for this one. So I have a Windows cluster, right? So I have my Windows cluster here. The name of the cluster. I have one witness disk, right? And let me see how many nodes I have. I have two nodes. So I have two nodes plus the witness disk, right? If I look into the details of the cluster, I see that it has a client access name. Remember, this is the name in the network that I can use to connect to my resource. In this case, the resource that I'm protecting is called a SQL Server. So I have my SQL Server being protected by Windows Cluster. What else we have? I think that's it. Do we have anything else? Oh, let's see, resources. So for resources, I have the name, again, the name in the network that I use to connect to SQL Server. It has a couple of IP addresses. And then I have SQL Server, right? This is what I'm protecting here. If I go to disks, so you see that I have three disks. So one of the disks is a witness disk. That one is to maintain quorum in the system. Remember that with SQL Cluster, we need to maintain quorum. That means two out of three members of the cluster need to be online. So I can do that with my witness disk. And then I have registered two cluster chair volumes, right? These two cluster chair volumes, if you look here, you'll notice that they are in the same physical drive. So I have C, I have my C drive, right? And then by default, all the cluster chair volumes live under the same path. It's called cluster storage. And I have two volumes in this case. I have volume one, and I have volume two, right? And this corresponds to these two and these three. So if I go to SQL Server, right, in this case, I have one user database plus my system databases, and then I run the first query. This query from master files basically tells me the physical location of all the data and log files for my databases. So you can see, for example, that my data and log file for master, TempDB, model, including my user databases, all of these live in cluster storage volume one, which is one of the cluster chair volumes that are registered in Windows Cluster, right? If I check the cluster disks that I have, so in SQL, I can look at all the disks that have been registered in Windows Cluster. I can see those cluster chair volumes. I can see the owner. The owner is the cluster node that will pass all the I/O requests. So any read or write that go into the storage will be handled by this node. If for some reason this node cannot connect to the storage, it will be handled by another node in the Windows Cluster. And this will tell me that this is a cluster chair volume, right? So again, the advantage is I can have as many as I want of these in the same physical drive. Right? So I could have multiple Windows clusters, for example, using different cluster chair bodies in the same SAN. And anything else works exactly the same as it works today. So I can go into roles, for example. I can right-click in my SQL Server and then say move. And then I can select the node. And I can fail over my SQL Server from Windows cluster to a different node. So I can just say, I want to move it to the other node. And it's going to be very fast. Again, the new node doesn't need to mount the drives. It can just automatically access the files on that on the cluster share volumes. All right, so I think I'm running out of time. Just a few things that are interesting to look at from the Windows cluster perspective. So if you're not running yet on Windows Server 2012 or Windows Server 2012 or 2, I'll invite you to look at it. There are many useful things from the SQL Server perspective. Better network resiliency, something called dynamic quorum. This is very good for the scenarios where one of the nodes may go down, for example, and then at some point another node may go down, so the Windows cluster will remove the boats out of those and still maintain quorum, so very useful for resiliency. And if you want to avoid Active Directory, for example, to register your names, like the cluster name or your listeners, you can do that now. So in Windows Server 2012 or 2, you can create clusters, for example, or availability groups without the need for storing the names in Active Directory. So thanks a lot for your time. Any questions? Yes. Anyone, sorry? Questions is, are in-memory tables supported? Yes, they are fully supported. There are no issues. So unfortunately, we're running out of time. I'm going to be here in case you have any questions. Thank you very much for coming.